On the Media is a listener-supported podcast. You like it, maybe even really like it. And to be honest, WNYC pays for most of it. So as the year draws to a close, consider this. If you donate by December 31st, your contribution will be matched dollar for dollar by the Tao Foundation. We've never had that kind of offer before, so give a little and we'll get twice as much. Just text OTM to 69866, a simple form will pop up and you can send a little something in a matter of seconds. Or go to onthemedia.org/support online and make your contribution there. You'll be our angel investor. No, you'll be a golden god.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the fifth Republican primary debate was held in Las Vegas. The theme was foreign policy, and in their opening statements, two candidates, Dr. Ben Carson and Senator Ted Cruz, zeroed in on the primary threat to our national security.
It's not a lack of competence that is preventing the Obama administration from stopping these attacks. It is political correctness.
And we should never give away the values and principles that made America into a great nation for the sake of political correctness.
We will stop the terrorist attacks before they occur because we will not be prisoners to political correctness.
Right now, the United States of America is the patient. And the patient is in critical condition and will not be cured by political correctness.
And political correctness is killing people.
Thank you.
Political correctness keeps us from defeating ISIS. Political correctness keeps us from winning at anything. Trump.
And I don't frankly have time for total political correctness. This country is in big trouble. We don't win anymore.
Carly Fiorina, not long ago.
By the way, there's way too much political correctness in politics. People are tired of sanitized sound bites and bumper sticker rhetoric.
And Jeb Bush last summer after being criticized for calling the children of immigrants anchor babies.
I think we need to take a step back and chill out a little bit as it relates to the political correctness that somehow you have to be scolded every time you say something.
Of course, this crop of contenders didn't invent the term. Jeb may have learned it from his dad, George H.W. Bush, who said at a commencement speech in 1991,
"We find free speech under assault throughout the United States, including on some college campuses. The notion of political correctness has ignited controversy across the land. And although the movement arises from the laudable desire to sweep away the debris of racism and sexism and hatred, it replaces old prejudice with new ones."
In the Washington Post this week, Philip Bump traced one of the first modern uses of the term politically correct to a 1934 New York Times article about pre-war Nazi Germany. It described how German journalists had to publish only politically correct opinions, those sanctioned by the state, or risk imprisonment. But no one in America risks jail for speaking his mind. Unless he's talking about killing the president, you know, like singer Ted Nugent in 2012.
Because I tell you this right now, if Barack Obama becomes the president in November again, I will either be dead or in jail by this time next year.
Oh, wait, he's not in jail, because obviously he was speaking metaphorically.
But when I kick the door down to the enemy's camp, would you help me shoot somebody? Just help me clear the room. And again, that's a metaphor, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not recommending shooting anybody.
Nugent's a putz, but he's not that stupid. So let's assume that the GOP presidential contenders are campaigning against political correctness, not because it threatens their right to speak, because it sure hasn't, but because it's popular. They can reasonably fuel their anti-PC campaign with the controversies now raging on college campuses over such things as trigger warnings, which were originally designed to flag material online that might trigger post-traumatic stress in the vulnerable, but are now employed to head off any speech that might offend, which of course means heading off a lot of speech. This week, Yale University inspired gasps when dozens of students signed a petition supporting repeal of the First Amendment. But what does political correctness really mean as invoked in this week's GOP debate? Judging by the comments of the candidates, it seems to mean that they are sick and tired of having to kowtow to what Fiorina calls bumper sticker rhetoric about liberal obsessions. At the debate, a question for Carson.
Could you do that? Could you order airstrikes that would kill innocent children by not the scores, but the hundreds and the thousands?
Carson temporizes about how he's had to give kids facing brain surgery the lowdown, and then says,
you have to be able to look at the big picture and understand that it's actually merciful if you go ahead and finish the job rather than death by a thousand pricks.
So you are okay with the deaths of thousands of innocent children and civilian? It's like...
You got it. You got it.
Yeah, the audience got it. Calling the slaughter of innocents a mercy was politically incorrect. So, apparently, is championing the suspension of the First Amendment when it comes to Islam, not Yale, and equal protection under the law, and the Fifth Amendment's edict that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Unless we rid ourselves of all this strangulating political correctness, America can never be great again.
Coming up, polls, you can't live with them, and you certainly can't avoid them.
This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. So we end another week in this endless election cycle, and you're inundated with polls. But they don't all send the same message.
Senator Ted Cruz leads Donald Trump 31% to 21% in the new Des Moines Register Bloomberg Politics poll. Cruz surging 21 points since August into the lead,
including this one from Monmouth University, which shows Trump at 41%. I think 27 points ahead of Ted Cruz.
Trump is winning and losing? What does that mean? And 10 months out from the general election, who cares? When do polls matter? For guidance on this and many other questions, we bring you another installment of our Breaking News Consumer's Handbook, this time Election Poll Edition. Harry Enten is a senior political writer and analyst at the data news site 538, our partner this season in probing the polls. Harry, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
What's going on?
Chaos. Chaos is going on. No. When you look at a primary, right, there are many different ways you can poll it. You could poll it state by state or nationally. Donald Trump is performing very well in the national polls right now. But in Iowa, he's actually trailing in the majority of the polls as he has throughout his entire candidacy.
Let's talk about what a national primary poll is. There is no national primary, so it measures nothing, right?
That's exactly what it is. Primary polls that are taken nationally are measuring something that doesn't actually exist. There is no national primary. You know, if you were to take a national primary poll average at this point and compare it in the past to how predictive it was, the margin of error is something like plus or minus 28 percentage points. So I ran a headline this past week where I said, Donald Trump may end up with anywhere between 8 and 64% of the vote. Primaries occur by a state-by-state basis, and the first primary is actually the Iowa caucus, and then you have the New Hampshire primary. So I would be paying attention to polls that are coming from both of those. At this point, they're still not all that predictive, but they get more predictive as we get closer to the primary, but they are certainly more predictive of those contests than the national polls are of the national primary.
So when should we start paying attention? Maybe 6 weeks before the caucus? Are we going to get anywhere near predictability at that point?
I mean, if somebody is leading by a very large margin, then yes, you know, whoever's leading 6 weeks out would have a pretty good shot of winning. But it's all a chain of events, right? You have to at least do well in Iowa or New Hampshire. And then if you do so, you can go on to win later primaries and win the nomination.
What about the general election? When should we start paying attention to national polls?
We know from the past that the general election polls right now are just not that predictive. Pay attention to national general election polls much further out from when the actual voting occurs. If there's someone who has, you know, a 3 or 4 or 5 point lead after both major party conventions, that person usually goes on to win the presidency.
You and other poll watchers pay close attention to how polls are conducted. What are we to look for?
Who is this pollster? Have we actually heard of this pollster? Do they have a good track record? The Des Moines Register poll by Ann Salzer has a tremendous track record, while somebody like Zogby Interactive has a horrible record. The American Research Group out of New Hampshire has not been tremendously accurate. Now, that doesn't mean they won't be or they're not trying to improve, but at least in the past, they haven't been particularly good.
What else?
Look at who you are sampling. Primaries tend to attract lower participation rates than presidential general elections. So we don't want to just take a poll of all the possible voters. We want to take a poll of likely voters, the people who are actually going to show up and vote in that primary.
And midterms.
And midterms as well. Basically, those elections in which we'll have a smaller turnout than presidential general elections. Polls that use, quote-unquote, likely voters tend to be more accurate than those that use registered voters.
What else?
How are you conducting that poll? Are you conducting it over the phone? Are you conducting it via the internet? Are you conducting it over the phone but with an automated dialer and then someone presses 1 for Mitt Romney, 2 for Barack Obama, 3 for undecided? Live interview polls have tended to be more accurate, especially in primaries, at least in the United States.
4 years ago, 21% of polling of the GOP primaries was done online. This year, it's half. I assume because it's way cheaper.
Yeah. I don't have to tell you that media budgets are decreasing. Newspapers, which traditionally have paid for state polling, they're going, goodbye, see you later. Media is looking for any way that they can cut costs, and internet polls are simply cheaper. That doesn't necessarily mean that they'll end up less accurate, but it could end up being the case.
You've observed that Donald Trump does a lot better when the interviewer is not a real person on the line. And this year, no live interview pollsters are producing weekly results. So the type of poll that favors Trump is in the news a lot more often.
It makes my job more difficult, and it makes the media consumer's job more difficult because they are being told constantly Donald Trump is at X percentage when the live interviewer polls actually have him at X percentage minus, say, 2 or 3 or 4 or 5, depending on the exact pollster.
Let's talk about the one bit of qualification that we, the news consumer, get every single time.
She has a 6-point lead, and the margin of error in that poll is 5.9%.
That poll has a margin of error of plus or minus 5 points.
And has a margin of error of 4.9%.
What the margin of error is, we're not always sure what that means. And you suggest that maybe it doesn't matter that much anyway?
There are any number of problems with this. The biggest problem is, if we go back to primary polls, very few people turn out for primaries. The margin of error assumes that you are polling the correct universe of actual primary voters. In fact, you may be polling people who are never going to show up for the Iowa caucus, for example. And then your margin of error, you can basically throw it out the window. I would much rather poll 350 people that I know are going to show up for the Iowa caucus than poll, say, 1,000 people and not really have any sort of clue whether or not they're going to show up.
Another way to play the averages here is, as you note, pay attention to averages and trends.
Because even the best pollsters, Ann Salzer, for instance, produced a poll in the middle of 2012, which had Barack Obama beating Mitt Romney by double digits, when pretty much all of the other polls showed a much closer race. Ann Salzer rightfully stood by her poll. She said, I did best methods, but sometimes you have outliers. And in this particular case, even the best had an outlier. So paying attention to the averages generally helps.
Let's talk about outliers. How are they often portrayed in the media?
Look, news media is always looking for a story. And the best story that you can get is an outlier. Oh my God, we have this brand new result and it shows something completely different.
A stunning new poll sure to shock the Clinton campaign this morning.
Just minutes away, a shocking new poll.
And some new polling numbers make a stunning forecast for the midterm elections.
So stay tuned to your local news next or whatever.
It's a stunner.
It's a stunner.
It's a bombshell.
So outliers tend to get outsized media attention, and most times outliers are outliers for a reason, and that is that they are incorrect.
This whole discussion reminds me of a personal bugaboo, which I bring up every time, and that is that stupid question always asked from the very beginning: who would you vote for if the election were tomorrow? Obviously, most people answer with a guess because the vast majority of people are still undecided, which would be obvious if you were to ask the real question: who are you going to vote for in November? The answer would be so full of undecideds, it wouldn't be worth a headline.
Maybe. Or they could offer undecided as a third option, right? Instead of just saying, are you going to vote for X or Y? You could say, are you going to vote for X, Y, or are you undecided at this point?
But they don't, do they?
They don't.
Another place where I think they try and drum up headlines is when they poll on hypothetical matchups. I mean, for a long time, they were matching Joe Biden with everybody under the sun. We have some others.
Quinnipiac University puts Ben Carson ahead of Hillary Clinton if the general election happened today.
Clinton versus Trump. She would win if that election were held today.
Hypothetical general election matchup. Bernie Sanders, Democratic nominee, beats Donald Trump, Republican nominee, by 8 points.
Isn't this business with the hypothetical matchups more about donors and less about the public?
You want to be the quote-unquote electable candidate, and that's something that these hypothetical matchups supposedly can tell you, though if I were a donor, I wouldn't buy it for a second.
So On the Media and 538 are collaborating now to look at this dance between polling and media coverage. We already know that the polls fuel media narratives, and that those media expectations do matter. You could lose Iowa and still win Iowa.
You can actually see this statistically, whereby a person who underperforms in Iowa, even if they win the Iowa caucus, then does worse than expected in New Hampshire because the media portrays that quote-unquote win as a loss, and somebody who actually loses but performs better than expectations, the exact opposite. So I go back to the 1984 Democratic primary, where Walter Mondale basically whooped Gary Hart in the state of Iowa. The media portrayed Hart as the winner because the media said that Hart performed better than expectations in Iowa, even though he finished only, I think, at like 17% of the vote. And then he was able to go on and win in New Hampshire.
Tonight in New Hampshire, we buried the label Dark Horse.
And then it was a race because the media is always looking to create a race.
Many have told us there's too much noise in the system for the polls to be productive at this point. Even some pollsters have warned that these debate lineups probably shouldn't be based so much on these noisy numbers. But the polls keep coming out. The media keep paying for them and reporting on them. Why?
People like to know what's going to happen, and they believe, rightly or wrongly, that polls can tell us what's going to happen, even though probably more wrongly in primaries, at least this far out.
Thanks a lot, Harry.
Thank you.
Harry Enten is a senior political writer and analyst for 538. You can find its election coverage at 538.com/politics. And there's a handy one-page edition of our Breaking News Consumer's Handbook Election Poll Edition at onthemedia.org.
We do love polls. It's true. It's fun to crow when our team is winning and even to fume when our team isn't. But they're more than just entertainment. In theory, they tell us the pulse of the country. They measure public support for political initiatives. They keep politicians answerable to their constituents, don't they? According to The New Yorker's Jill Lepore, not so much. In her recent article titled Politics and the New Machine, Lepore retraces the often sorry history of polling in America.
The word poll means the top of your head, like the crown of your head. You can find it in Hamlet, where Ophelia says of Polonius, he has a beard as white as snow, all flaxen was his poll. Before the rise of the paper ballot, people always voted in person. Like, you'd go to the town hall, someone would stand up, you know, on a tree trunk or something and look across the crowd and count the polls, count the tops of the heads of people on one side of the town common or the other. So that place came to be called the polls, where you would go to have your polls counted.
And then pollster was
The word pollster is coined in 1939. It's applied to George Gallup by Time magazine, which calls him a pollster. It's a bit of an homage to the great word huckster. It was a time when people were really suspicious of polls. It was a new thing, and Congress was repeatedly calling for investigations of the industry, really concerned about its role in electoral politics. We've come to accept polls as if this was a necessary piece of our electoral process. But of course, before then, that really was not the case. We had a kind of healthy criticism at the time that we, I think, have since lost.
Polls have long since gone beyond their original purpose, pre-election polls, that is, which was to track how various candidates are faring. And I wonder if you could just list the ways in which polls have become so part of the process.
They drive donors. They determine messages. They determine clout. They determine who can run. This is the first presidential election season where polls have been used to decide who gets to be on the main stage in a debate or where people stand on stage. There's just more polls. Every news story seems to need a poll to have any foundation.
All of that is fine, assuming that poll data really reflect public opinion. But there, for many reasons that you enumerate in your piece, polling doesn't necessarily accurately reflect anything. Why?
In 1935, when George Gallup founded the American Institute of Public Opinion, he sent people door to door and talked to people for maybe about 45 minutes. And the response rate, that is the percentage of people who were asked who actually answered those questions when someone knocked at the door, was like well above 90, like 95, 96%. People were thrilled that someone came to their door and asked them what they thought. Now, a response rate of 3% is a not uncommon response rate. So even if you set aside all the other problems with polls, when only 3% of the people that you ask questions to reply, the idea that what you're getting is a statistically representative sample of the electorate is very difficult to defend.
There's another problem that you discuss, and that is that the process itself influences opinion.
It's fascinating. There's a whole very sophisticated literature that political scientists have been developing for decades on the many methodological problems of public opinion measurement. So one is this phenomenon of forced opinion. I ask you, do you favor the Smeadville-Hartley Act? And you say yes, even though you don't even know what it is. Or I ask you a leading question about that, and you say yes. There's also the problem of non-opinion. So many pollsters, if you say, I don't know, even if I don't know isn't an option, when they report their findings, won't report the percentage of respondents who said, I don't know.
One of the presumptions of polling is that it helps political leaders understand the jaws of consent, how much leeway they have to think independently versus what they owe their constituencies to represent them in Congress or wherever. But the nature of polling, particularly in elections, is that it mainly concerns itself with those likely to vote, which limits the politician's understanding of what people want to those who are willing to go to the ballot box. It disenfranchises some percentage of the population?
Yeah, and here's where, I mean, if you think back to the 1930s when Gallup was developing this tool, he argued that public opinion measurement was the best thing for democracy really since the secret ballot, because instead of learning the will of the people every 2 years when it came around time to vote, we, the American public, could understand the will of the people every day. Candidates could therefore be more responsive. The premise of that, though, would seem to be, and Gallup certainly would have said this at the time and did, that the people whose views are represented in the public opinion survey should be a representative sample of the American electorate. And there's where the sampling methods really matter a great deal. In practice, though, in order for not the surveys, that is, asking people their questions, they're asking people questions about their political beliefs and attitudes, but asking people who they're going to vote for, in order to make polls accurate predictions, you really only want to count the opinions of people who are going to turn out to vote. So Gallup worked by a quota system, and he just basically determined that since blacks in the South were prevented from voting, that he would have no Negro quota in any of the Southern states, and he just didn't ask black men and women how they would vote. So those polls that Gallup invented and used to measure the pulse of the American people actually only exacerbated the problems of disenfranchisement that were already weakening the democracy.
You can argue that politicians should be keeping their finger on the pulse of the electorate, and you can argue that the public deserves to know what everybody else in the body politic is thinking about a given subject. But the larger philosophical questions are, do polls seek the answers for something that doesn't even exist, namely public opinion itself?
Gallup was an ex-academic. He had gotten a PhD in applied psychology. He founded his institute at Princeton so that the Gallup Institution would have Princeton as its byline and would seem to be an academic endeavor. But social scientists from the start were extremely skeptical of the work that Gallup was doing, because is the opinion of the public, are individual opinions in aggregate given equal weight that taken in an instant as a snapshot? That's actually not really defensible as a matter of social science. In 1948, right after Gallup said, you know, just watch, we'll get this election right. And then, you know, he predicted that Dewey would beat Truman, and he was famously wrong. And E.B. White, writing in The New Yorker a few days later, said, well, you know, it may be possible to take the pulse of the American people, but you can't always be sure that the American people haven't just run up a flight of stairs.
There's another actor in all of this, and that's the media. We're sort of accessories after the fact to the very kind of distortion that you're writing about.
I would quibble a little with your characterization of the press as accessories after the fact. I think the press is really the culprit here. I mean, Gallup, he was just selling a product to newspapers. He then started predicting elections just to prove that his surveys were accurate. Turned out, hey, wow, readers love these election predictions. Let's do more of them. It then became really thrilling for candidates. They're like, oh, wow, we could hire these polling firms to tell us about our candidates' chances. And this is this really important turning point in 1972 when news organizations began conducting their own polls. The press is actually not then reporting news, but is creating news. Gallup himself then came to regret this. In 1972, Congress debated a Truth in Polling Act. And Gallup was sort of like, you know, please reform the industry. This has like been taken over by a bunch of people that don't actually care about accuracy the way that I do.
We have an arrangement at On the Media with 538 for the course of this election cycle. And they made a name for themselves with a methodology for aggregating poll results in a way that favors accurate polls and subordinates inaccurate ones. But you kind of took a shot at them in your piece. You said it's a patch, not a solution.
I mean, I'm full of admiration for that work. But there are two problems. One is that good polls drive bad polls. The more unreliable polls have become, the more we rely on them. So the idea that you could sort of just say, this poll's good, this poll's bad, and therefore then we've washed our hands of the problem is a bit of a fallacy. And the other thing that's really worth noting is that other countries have laws and requirements about the non-conducting of polls this far in advance of election, because the way in which they interfere with the democratic process has been demonstrated. It's incredibly helpful to say, hey, this poll is known to be reliable, and this poll is known to be unreliable, and let's make a prediction based on weighting the reliable one disproportionately. But it skirts the broader questions about how we choose to govern ourselves.
Well, I have one more question for you, and it concerns, naturally, Donald Trump. Has the polling culture, and particularly the way the press depends on it, created this monster?
I think it would be fair to say that Trump is a creature of the polls. One upside here is that for all the many occasions in which quite thoughtful people have issued quite thoughtful critiques of the polling industry and asked the American people to wonder whether this is in fact corrosive of our democracy, manufacturing divides that don't exist rather than reflecting something, that the kind of uncanny rise of Donald Trump might be an occasion to actually get a little more attention to that set of critiques.
Yeah, is that going to happen?
Do I think that can happen? No. No.
Jill, thanks very much.
Hey, thanks so much.
Jill Lepore teaches at Harvard and is a staff writer for The New Yorker, where she wrote Politics and the New Machine.
Coming up, the Paris talks. What did they mean? What did we report? What do you care? It's not about ISIS.
This is On the Media.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Media outlets from NBC to Mother Jones have called the Paris climate change deal landmark and historic. Obama declared it a turning point for the world. But many climate change activists, like Bill McKibben, founder of 350.org, decry the deal as woefully insufficient. James Hansen, the NASA scientist who drew attention to climate change in 1988, called the deal a fraud. Clarity is hard to find amid all the conflicting commentary, but we're going to try. Andrew Revkin has been reporting on climate change for more than three decades. He writes the New York Times blog .earth. Thanks for coming on, Andy.
Great to be with you.
And Jonathan Katz covered the talks in Paris for the New Republic. Hi, Jonathan.
Hey.
How is it covered in the U.S., aside from the general confusion that I cited in the intro?
This is Jonathan. Every day when I would come home from Le Bourget, I would kind of check in on social media and see like, oh, I wonder what people back in the States are saying about this. And of course, they were saying basically nothing. Everybody was talking about Donald Trump. They were talking about the shootings in San Bernardino. They were talking about ISIS. There were very, very few people who were talking about the climate conference.
Andy, when the deal was finished, it did get a lot of coverage, but mostly I saw it covered as a political issue.
It is covered that way in large part because the news media look for news often through the filter of what we think news looks like. And it's covered as a strategic thing, who wins, who loses, what strategy was used. And those stories are all important, but they do miss that kind of reality of the background forcings on the system, which are changing our planet in ways that henceforth, for actually a millenniums, there'll be no new normal coastline. I mean, to me, as I think I told you on this show about 10 years ago, that's breaking news.
But that's not what we hear. We see things more like, what does this mean for Obama's legacy?
This is Jonathan again. It was sort of the usual suspects, but you had people like Jonathan Chait.
In New York Magazine.
In New York Magazine, exactly, yeah. And Tom Friedman's column in the New York Times was sort of similar. They kind of rushed out to show that this was a big win for the Obama administration. It was very much what the State Department was trying to sell, and the White House as well, which was basically that this is American leadership, and this is Obama who's come in, and he's making this deal happen. And the thing that really missed was any kind of real discussion about what exactly it was that the United States was trying to accomplish.
Because it's still such a touchy issue in the U.S., this whole climate change thing, do you think that led the mainstream press to go easier on this deal than they otherwise might have?
Yeah, I definitely think there's been a little bit of walking on eggshells in terms of really criticizing the meat of the deal, because people know that in the United States, if you give an inch to the crowd that just essentially wants everybody to stop talking about climate change until we're all living underwater, they'll take it and run with it and try to use it to change the topic as quickly as possible. Because we just have this really messed up debate in this country with basically one half of the conversation at least trying to cope with reality of climate change and the other side with its head just completely buried in the sand. And so you had a lot of Republican media like the National Review who were trying to blow holes in the deal just so that they could prove that it was a giant waste of time and it was nothing you should pay attention to. But what that missed was any kind of real conversation about what this deal did and didn't do and the reasons that it did and didn't do it.
So what does this deal do and not do? Andy?
Remember, this is just the thumbnail sketch of a fuller deal that would be adopted by 2020. It basically creates a binding process by which countries individually pledge to change course from business as usual on carbon dioxide and these other gases and on deforestation. And the rich countries have firmed up a little bit the language by which they will create a fund that will compensate poor ones for climate impacts that are the result of these changes in the system from the warming that's happening. What they've created is an architecture for getting everybody, in a very nudgy Cass Sunstein way, getting everybody to move forward. And one of the promising things going forward, and this relates to the media too, and not just the conventional journalist media, but the transparency that's imposable on the world now in terms of tracking deforestation rates or how much coal is being used is very promising because it makes this more doable without having kind of a global carbon police. One demonstration of this was that just ahead of these talks, China came out with much more honest numbers for its coal-based emissions. And I think that shows you that it's just getting harder to cheat. Think about Volkswagen. You know, they cheated for 4 or 5 years, but the revelations that led to that came from independent analysis. You know, that's doable on a global scale now more and more, and also with the remote sensing satellites in terms of things like deforestation. So there is a promising prospect of having progress without a carbon police.
So this deal calls for or firmly suggests that 187 countries pledge to cut their emissions to limit global warming to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, which people say is impossible to achieve. So is this purely symbolic?
This is something that people were talking about a lot. The problem was we're already on track to go past that based on the emissions that have already been emitted. And when you add up the individual countries' pledges that are the voluntary part of this agreement, we're going to blow right past that really quickly. So what's the point of even having that language? But the main thing that people were saying that was positive was if at the very least we have this as a goal, then countries can at least shame one another, or when they're talking to each other in bilateral negotiations, they can say, hey, look, you agreed to this and we agreed to this and let's both go for this together. And that maybe in some way through some kind of international body English, we might be able to lean closer to that target.
There are so many fantastical aspects to this whole process. We are not even remotely engaged in the kind of energy push that you would need to decarbonize a world that's still more than 80% dependent on fossil fuels, where the United States, the nuclear power plants that we have are all old and we're not building or designing new ones, where the demand for energy that goes with progress is fundamental and not subject to diplomacy. I wrote a couple of years ago about a knife fight between two families in the Himalayas over firewood. And they need any kind of energy more than they need firewood because they've already just depleted the trees of all the low-hanging branches.
So how is this a turning point?
Because the process has acknowledged this. It used to be literally a magical thinking process. The Kyoto Protocol was magical thinking.
In what way?
It had binding targets and tables, but it had all kinds of loopholes. We now acknowledge that we can't solve this the way we thought we could. You know, this was the first time since covering this since 1988 when I saw, not in the treaty diplomacy, but at least in the ancillary announcements, commitments to basic research and development to say we need more science here too. We don't know how to do this. And those are all, like, to me, tweaks in the right direction.
Now, one reason the agreement isn't legally binding is because the U.S. got everyone to agree to change the word shall to should, because requiring accountability could allow the Republicans in Congress to kill it. It seems like these climate deniers yield a disproportionate influence over global climate change policy. Jonathan, did this come up in Paris?
Yeah, it was really surprising to me. Basically, the head European climate change negotiator from Spain, Miguel Arias Cañete, gets up and he's answering a question about why this agreement can't actually require cuts to emissions or actually require that the developed countries, the rich countries, pay money that they have said or at least vaguely implied that they would pay to help developing countries and seriously poor countries deal with the effects of climate change. And his answer was Congress, the Senate, and the Republican Party. Big Spanish dude with a white beard who's standing up in front of the room and blaming the Republicans for this. And I have a feeling that to a certain extent that might have been a little bit oversold. U.S. presidential administrations in general don't really need any help not wanting to be bound to international accountability. But nonetheless, the specter of the Republican Party was haunting Europe across this entire conversation.
I wrote a piece earlier in the year called No Red and Blue States When It Comes to Renewable Energy Progress and Even Regulating Carbon Dioxide as a Pollutant. This was based on Yale and Utah State study. State by state, they came out with a map of the country's attitudes on putting more federal investment into renewable energy research and also into restricting carbon dioxide from power plants as a pollutant. And there's no red and blue. That whole map that we live by in political reporting goes away when you ask those kinds of questions. By making it all about your views on the severity of global warming, that enables the polarization of an issue where there actually, behind the scenes, is a lot of common thinking.
So what about the polls that suggest a large percentage of Americans don't believe in climate change?
Those polls, don't get me started. The only poll that matters, both in terms of politics and, you know, how many people are reading these stories that we're all writing, are how salient is global warming to you? The ones that just ask you, what worries you? Pause. Almost everybody fills in that blank with the economy, healthcare, you know, getting my kids to school. And climate change perpetually, since the 80s, has not budged really in its salience.
There is something really interesting, though, and you've probably seen the same thing, Andy, is that there is a shift that is going on even in the rhetoric of very senior people in the Republican Party. Comments that Jeb Bush has made about climate change, even comments that people like Charles Koch have made about climate change. There's more of an appreciation that it's real, and they're trying to find other ways to talk about it, basically saying, well, it's not really going to be catastrophic, or yeah, it's real and people are affecting it, but that's not the whole story, or the problems that we're seeing, we're really not going to see until so far down the road that we don't even need to talk about it now. So the upshot for them is still the same, which is basically don't touch the oil industry, but they're starting to have to admit that reality is reality. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see the way that debate changes even over the course of the coming presidential election and after that.
So what's the story that isn't getting told here?
The thing that's disappointed me the most about seeing the way that this thing has been covered is the way that this is still treated by most of the press in the United States as being this sort of esoteric side issue. I mean, at the Republican debate in Las Vegas, there wasn't a single question asked on CNN about the Paris talks. The only time that climate change came up at all was for John Kasich of Ohio to make fun of the fact that there was a climate summit at all. He said that it should have been canceled and basically the 33,000 people who came to Paris to talk about this thing should have all switched expertise and started talking about ISIS instead. And then I think at some point Donald Trump made some kind of weird, dumb joke about it. And that was it. When this is our world, this is the central core issue that people in my generation, I'm 35 years old, for the rest of our lives, this is going to be the most important stuff that we deal with. And yet the coverage just sort of assumes that it's like, oh yeah, it's this boring thing and people went to Paris and they ate baguettes and they had this conversation and now let's talk about ISIS. When really, compared to climate change, ISIS is the sideshow. It's really frustrating to me. I just wish that more people who were paying attention to this would begin to understand that.
The media still are essentially reflecting how we as a species, H. sapiens, the sapient aspect of us is still largely built around the here and now, meaning things that are local to you. I hope that artists and psychologists and everyone along with engineers and political science students is thinking, I have a role to play here in seeing if there's a way for us to integrate information in ways that give us a longer view of how we act, what we invest in. How can we build a reader who is able to step back and capture the big picture? I don't know. I don't know what the answer is there.
You said we have to build a news consumer that can handle this stuff, but that's just not how the business works.
I have good news and bad news, and they're the same thing, which is that this is becoming breaking news. This is happening in real time. For instance, I just came back from the Caribbean. I was out there talking to farmers, and the farmers are reeling right now from a really, really bad drought. I was in Cuba a couple weeks before that, and the same thing was happening in Cuba as well. And there's nothing more local. There's no more local news than farmers not being able to grow crops because the weather's changed. You can actually go out to places, and you can see the effects on people's day-to-day lives. And the good and bad news for journalists is that that's going to make telling these stories a lot easier, and it's also going to shift the needle in terms of what public opinion is.
Well, thank God for that. Jonathan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Katz covered the talks in Paris for the New Republic. And Andrew, thank you very much.
It was great to be with you again.
Andrew Revkin writes the New York Times blog, .earth.
This year, The Guardian's outgoing editor, Alan Rusbridger, announced a major new initiative, his last at the newspaper, to put some heat into its global warming coverage. He told us about it in April.
I think people feel helpless in the face of this story. They see governments finding it very hard to agree on action, and I think they've stopped reading. So one of the purposes of starting a campaign was to give them something to do. And the reaction has been very, very positive.
The Guardian focused its campaign called Keep It in the Ground explicitly on the world's two largest charitable health organizations, the Wellcome Trust and the Gates Foundation. The something to do was the agitation in the form of articles and petitions urging investors to pull their money from fossil fuel stocks, not only because it's urgent environmentally, but because the world's oil reserves are declining in value on their way to being nearly worthless.
Otherwise, we'll have to sit back and wait for the political leaders to go to Paris and do something, which they might or they might not. But I think they're unlikely to move unless they feel the hot wind of public interest on their necks.
That was 8 months ago. Now, after Paris, we're checking back in on the Guardian's efforts to push for divestment with their partners at 350.org, but also to reshape climate change coverage. Russ Bridger's successors have since moved on to what they're calling phase two of the climate change campaign, hope. James Randerson is an editor at The Guardian, and he focuses on environment and science news. James, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get to the hope part, let's begin with the glory. Is there any so far? What did happen with the Wellcome Trust and the Gates Foundation?
We're still waiting for them to do the right thing, but I think there is some glory to go around. Organizations worth in total $3.4 trillion have now made a commitment of one kind or another to divest. That's over 500 organizations. I think that's a pretty amazing statement from civil society. Gates said that he thinks that divestment is, quote, a false solution. He takes, I think, quite a literal view. He is saying, you know, somebody buys the shares, somebody sells the shares, but nothing really changes in the real world.
If someone divests them, someone else is purchasing them.
Exactly. But we would say actually something quite profound is happening there because it's about a political statement. And the sum total of those political statements has been adding up. There is now a local campaign that's sprung up in Seattle that is putting pressure locally on the Gates organization there. Gates, though, separately and interestingly, back in the summer, made a big announcement about putting $2 billion into research into renewable energy technologies. And now we'll never know, but I think that he was feeling the pressure of the campaign. And although he didn't agree with divestment, that was his response.
Throwing you a $2 billion bone.
Yes, exactly.
If I understand correctly, he also argued against the divestment campaign on sort of psychological grounds, that by focusing on divestment and not on pending catastrophe, you and other climate advocates were leaving, if you will, a lot of reserves of environmental passion in the ground untapped.
Environmentalists have been talking about catastrophe for a long time, and arguably it hasn't got very far. As a newspaper, journalistically, we've been talking about catastrophe a lot. And, you know, as Alan said in that clip, a large group of people have stopped reading those kind of stories. You know, the argument that Gates is making that there's some kind of sort of finite well of concern and that by diverting the concern over here, it means less gets done over there. I'm not sure it really works like that. What we've seen with this campaign is loads of organizations have made the decision to divest.
James, the original campaign was supposed to empower readers to make them feel that they weren't just hapless victims, but that they could actually participate in the solution. You have gone in and spoken to readers in focus groups. What did they tell you?
So one of our fears was that people would react by saying, I don't trust The Guardian anymore now because they've turned into an NGO or something like that. Nobody said that. The very clear message that we had back from people was that we want to have a sense that this is possible. This big change that you're talking about in society and in the global economy is doable, because so much of what you read about climate change is about doom and gloom, how difficult it is. And frankly, most sensible people reading those stories will want to just go and curl up in bed under their duvet and not think about it too hard. And also, I think it made us realize how difficult actually divestment is as a concept to get across. But, you know, the biggest thing that came out for us was people wanted hope.
Climate change isn't necessarily a subject that newspapers look to for feel-good coverage. What has The Guardian found to give its readers hope?
we wanted to make the point that there's a lot going on out there that shows us a way that we are going to be able to change this economy, or at least potentially we are. And in particular, we wanted to highlight solar power, because the cost of solar is just coming down so rapidly, and that is transforming the economics. Back in 2009 at the Copenhagen climate talks, the green economy more generally, solar power in particular, it felt a bit like it was a PowerPoint presentation the politicians were being offered, and was really a bit of an unknown. That's one of the reasons, I think, why the stars were just simply not aligned for some kind of agreement at Copenhagen. And the cost of solar has come down 70% since then, and it's continuing to fall, and it's falling faster than people predicted. And that is going to make the whole transition much easier, and is going to mean that rather than this being about huge costs and government subsidies and taxes and all that kind of thing, if the right policy frameworks are put in place, it will happen.
You mentioned, as did Russ Bridger, that climate journalism has become a kind of fearful background noise. Environmentalists say the sky is falling and the public just pulls up the covers. Now comes your "the sky can be propped up" message. I wonder if there's a risk to suddenly offering hope. Will hope be mistaken for an all clear?
It's a very good point. I mean, I think it's more about turning the dial a bit. I think we realized that we were just underdoing the bit that actually people are probably most interested in, which is how are we going to get where we need to go? And so, you know, we've done a succession of stories about sending reporters out to places like Burundi, Rwanda, Chile, where there are some really groundbreaking renewable energy projects. But that doesn't mean that we're not doing the new bits of science that come out. We're not doing investigations into fossil fuel companies and all the other things that we were doing before.
James, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
James Randerson is an editor at The Guardian, where he focuses on environment and science coverage.
It is delusional for President Obama and Hillary Clinton and anyone else to say that climate change is our near-term most severe security threat. It is ISIS, period.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Alex Friedland and Dasha Litsitsina, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Means.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.